So welcome to another in the series of Moments of Light. And tonight I'm absolutely thrilled to be talking to somebody who I've been reading his books for about 2 or 3 years now. And I can't believe we're actually, we're talking, I feel like I know you already. Steve Taylor, author and lecturer, who has written 4 books, Waking for Sleep, The Fall, Making Time, and a new book, Out of Darkness. And you're a lecturer and researcher in transpersonal psychology. Is that right, Steve?
That's right, yeah. Hi, Tom. Yeah, that's right. I lecture at Leeds Metropolitan University in, different courses, but they all have a spiritual, transpersonal aspect to them. For example, I do a course on consciousness studies, which looks at scientific explanations of consciousness all the way through to spiritual explanations as well. And I'm also doing research on spiritual transformations as well.
Well, I had to look up tonight before I spoke to you what transpersonal psychology meant, assuming that there's other people out there that don't know what it means. Could you explain what it is?
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't really like the term myself because it's a bit misleading. People think in terms of interpersonal psychology. They think it's something to do with relationships. But it's spiritual psychology. It should really be called spiritual psychology. So it looks into the psychology of spiritual experiences, of mystical experiences, higher states of consciousness. It looks into religions and altered states of consciousness. So yeah, it's the name is a bit misleading, but it's transpersonal, as in trans ego, if you like, beyond the ego. It looks into states of consciousness which are beyond the ego, if you like.
Yeah, because you apart from writing these fabulous books which I've been reading, you also do a lot of papers, and I found one today on your website. It says, "Beyond the pre-stroke trans fallacy, the validity of pre-egoistic spiritual experience." I'm even having trouble saying that phrase. And the reason I bring it up is I just wonder how, because I love the way you write, and I love the way that you take these very complex concepts and make them very accessible. But how do you balance this Steve the university kind of guy, the academic, and Steve the author? How do you balance that? How do you find that your peers find you in university land?
Yeah, it's kind of difficult because I actually do journalism as well. I write for sometimes write for Psychology's magazine and magazines like Natural Health. So I also write in a journalistic style sometimes, which is different from my normal style when I'm writing my books. But yeah, it's just a question of using a slightly different set of principles. Like when I do academic writing, I'm aware that the language has to be slightly more formal. The articles have to be well referenced with a fairly long bibliography. And yeah, there's a certain procedure you have to follow, but it's not so difficult really. I think if you can write as an author, if you can write in an accessible way as an author to a popular audience, it actually stands you in good stead for academic writing, because my peers will hate me for saying this, but most academics are not particularly good writers. Because they're essentially not writers, they're maybe teachers or researchers. But so if you can write academic material in a fairly clear and accessible way, it actually stands you in good stead, because you can be very clear in your theories and your philosophies that you're putting across. So it's just a question of really following knowing what the audience is and following different procedures and different principles.
And what was your entry into authorship, Steve? Did you find that you authored first and the awakenings that you've obviously had happened second, or was it the awakening first and then you started writing about it?
Well, it's difficult to distinguish the two things, really. But I was originally, I always wanted to be a writer. I always knew from the age of 17 or so that I wanted to write. And I started writing stories, first of all, because I was always interested in English at school, and I studied literature at university. So I was never really thinking in terms of writing nonfiction. For a long time, I wrote stories and I wrote a couple of novels. But I always had the itch to write. I just loved to sit at the table with a blank piece of paper in front of me and just fill it with words. And, I could write for hours at a time. But it was only sort of... After about 10 years of Well, I occasionally dipped into non-fiction as well, and wrote philosophical stuff, but it was mainly non-fiction. But after about 10 years of writing non-fiction, I'd always been interested in spirituality, I'd always been interested in meditation, I read books about spirituality, so it kind of triggered that I really should be writing about spirituality and philosophy, because that was what I was really interested in. But somehow I'd never put the two things together. So, yeah, I mean, I began to write a journal. I recorded my spiritual experiences or my thoughts in a journal. And eventually my non-fiction writing grew out of my journal. You know, the journal slowly transformed into a book. And, yeah, so it was a gradual process, really.
Well, that's an amazing process, because if you actually look at what you've achieved, and I'm just talking about the book Waking from Sleep, Eckhart Tolle said it's one of the best books on spiritual awakening I've ever come across. I mean, that's an incredible accolade, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very kind of him to say that. Yeah, I mean, I originally got in contact with him when I read his book, A New Earth. I think it was in 2005 it came out on exactly the same day as my book before. I think it was October 30th, 2005. So I read New Earth and think, wow, this is very similar to The Fall. A lot of it was, especially when he talks about the history of the human race and how the human race suffers from pathology and has always been insane. I mentioned some very similar ideas in The Fall. So I wrote to him and sent him a copy of The Fall just to his office. And a few months later, his secretary sent me an email saying, Eckhart really likes The Fall and he wants to help you promote it if he can. Can he, you know, would you like him to give an endorsement? And I said, oh, yeah, I'd like him to give me an endorsement. That'd be great. And then he recommended The Fall on his website and gave me a really good endorsement for the cover. And then I kept in contact off and on and sent him Waking from Sleep when it came out, well, actually before it came out. And, yeah, so he kindly gave me an endorsement for that as well. And then, of course, I interviewed him for my new book, Out of the Darkness, as well. Because, I mean, obviously, as probably anybody who's read The Power of Now knows, Eckhart was, he was somebody who went through a great deal of suffering and turmoil in his early life. And that culminated in when he was 29. He had this, you know, great spiritual awakening when he was 29 after being in the depths of depression.
Mm. And that's the theme that you really, I guess it's come to the fore in this latest book, isn't it, Out of the Darkness, is why so much spiritual awakening seems to happen through trauma.
It was something that I was never really aware of before. I mean, I collected examples of spiritual experiences from friends and acquaintances, and then I ended up teaching a course at the University of Manchester on happiness, the psychology of happiness. It was to extramural adult students. And I taught that course for about 3 or 4 years, and we always did a section on peak experiences, spiritual experiences at the moment of peak happiness. And I always collected, I asked people to write down examples of their peak experiences, just choose one, choose the most intense peak experience and describe it for me. And I was surprised that a lot of them actually came from moments of turmoil. You know, one lady wrote about when she was going through a divorce and it was very tumultuous and stressful, that suddenly, you know, in the midst of all the stress, something gave way and she felt this amazing sense of peace. And a few people told me about, you know, when they'd always reached a point of nervous breakdown or they'd suffered a bereavement. One guy told me about when he'd hit rock bottom through becoming, when he was an alcoholic. So, you know, I was never really aware of it, but through collecting the experiences, I became aware of how common it was to experience spiritual awakening or spiritual experiences after turmoil. So I think it was actually, is probably, from my research anyway, it probably is the most frequent trigger of spiritual experiences. I mean, nature is a big trigger, meditation is a big trigger, but you know, I think by a couple of percentage points, the most frequent trigger is experiences of turmoil and suffering.
Interesting. One of the most intriguing characters I came across was this chap called the Launderette Guru, who is just one of these people you just got to meet in your life, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he was, that was a long time ago. It was actually probably about 13 or 14 years ago now. It was just, I'd been away from Manchester for a long time. I was originally born in Manchester, but I moved away for a few years and came back. And one of my friends who knew I was interested in spirituality told me about this guy who worked at who ran the local laundrette, and how he'd gone there, and this guy had given him this sort of this sermon about spirituality, and he was apparently a really intriguing person. So I went down there and took my next load of washing over to the laundrette, and straight away I knew it was a different kind of laundrette to usual, because there were inspirational quotes on the wall, and you know, it was painted in attractive bright colours, not that usual drab, depressing laundrette. And then I was just sitting there waiting for my clothes to be washed, and he came over and talked to me. And he was, I quickly found out that he was somebody who'd had a spiritual awakening. And it wasn't for him, it wasn't so much a stress at all, it was the fact of coming close to death that woke him up. He'd had a giant heart attack about 10 years previously. And before then, he'd been a businessman. He'd been fairly successful, materialistic kind of person. But after his encounter with death, everything changed. He recovered from the heart attack, and all his values were different. He could no longer see any value in material things, and he sold his business, and you know, he felt incredibly appreciative of the fact of being alive. And you know, and his idea was he bought a laundrette so that he could tell people about what happened to him and try to spread some of his enlightenment to them. So yeah, he was a really impressive guy. But unfortunately, I lost contact with him. I didn't go to the laundrette for a few years, and then it disappeared. I don't know where he is now. We've kind of lost. Well, he'd probably be quite old now, because he was already in his 70s when I spoke to him, so he's probably retired now.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful laundrette, to paraphrase a film title.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Steve, what was your awakening process?
Well, I didn't have a dramatic transformation like some of the people I write about in After the Darkness. For me, it was more like something that was innate from quite a young age. It was something that I felt as though I was born with, and which developed slowly as I got older. So when I was 16, 17, that was when I first became aware of what I would say something spiritual. That's when I felt a sense of connection to nature. That's when I began to feel, you know, a sense of serenity, a sense of stillness when I was in nature. And yeah, so it was something which slowly grew. At first, when I was young, I didn't really understand it, and I kind of, in a sense, I probably tried to repress it in a way, because it didn't feel like it was socially acceptable, and I felt like it made me different to other people. But so in my sort of later teenage years, early 20s, it was quite difficult, because there was a part of myself which didn't really accept or understand. But by the time I was in my early 20s, I'd started to gravitated towards books about spirituality, about mysticism. So I'd recognised something of my own experiences in the books I was reading. And so that, you know, that's when I felt as I began to understand myself, and I began to feel a sense of orientation, if you like.
And your first book was The Fall, is that right? And when did that come out? Was that about, you said, 2005?
Yeah, The Fall came out in 2005, yeah.
And how prescient was that now? Now you're seeing the sort of shift that we seem to be experiencing at the moment. Were you a little bit ahead of the curve there?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, a lot of the book deals with the past. Most of the book is about the history, or the prehistory of the human race. It goes back to, you know, 10,000 BC and the phase in history when human beings were hunter-gatherers. So it looks into the transition from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle to the agricultural lifestyle and the growth of civilization. So it's a book which is mainly about history. But in the final section of the book, I suggest that we're moving in, or possibly moving into, what I call the transfall era. So the idea was that there was a pre-fall era of human history, when you know, most societies were fairly harmonious and warfare was fairly uncommon. Some of those societies were fairly democratic, and women had high status. But then the fall occurred, which was a massive cultural transformation, which had its origins in a psychological transformation. But that changed the you know, human societies radically, warfare became really common, societies became hierarchical, women had low status, and human life became full of conflict and suffering. So that's been, you know, for the past few thousand years, we've been living through this this era of conflict and suffering. But at the moment, you know, I suggest that towards the end of the book that we're moving into, slowly moving into a new era now, the what I call the Transfall era. And so slowly, in a sense, we're returning to the pre-fall state, we're turning full circle. So, you know, we're regaining a sense of connection to nature. Societies are becoming more egalitarian. The sense of compassion is developing so that people who are in some way are different, people who, minority groups or, you know, people who in the past would have been maltreated or oppressed, you know, there's a sense of compassion spreading to other groups and other people, so that we're moving beyond the kind of brutality and oppression which has filled human history in the past.
Well, that's amazing, because actually, I've still a book of yours I've not read, Steve, but I'm just going to add it to my Amazon wishlist straight away and have a look at it. Because you've got this uncanny knack, actually, because I've got a book in the back of my mind at the moment, which is kind of dealing with the same kind of topic, but kind of going towards the future. And you talked before about Eckhart Tolle's very kindly giving you testimonials for your books, but you've been incredibly kind to me on my journey as an author as well. And there's a quote on the front of my book Blocks from you, there's a quote right in the start of my book on Lightbulb Moments from you, and what I love about this sort of author fraternity that I seem to find myself in, that you're in as well, is how supportive we all are to each other. And of course the best thing you can do as an author is to have a quote in someone else's book that bigs up your book, which is always a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's quite a strange occupation being an author, because it's quite an isolated occupation. You know, in any other profession, you have a lot of contact with your peers and your colleagues, but as an author, you know, you're sort of enclosed in your room, and you have very little contact with other authors. There's no sort of an annual convention of authors where we all meet and get drunk together. But
well, maybe we should change that, because I think there's a theme growing here. Because in your book Making Time, I was about to write a book. I started to have some weird experiences about time, where I started to jump time. So I'd be sitting in a room, and I'd go back about 10 or 20 seconds,
oh, yeah?
And I'd relive some time, mm-hmm. right? And then I went on a course, study past life regression, and I started seeing people's past lives and their auras and future lives and their auras. So I thought, this is interesting. The time isn't as permanent as we think.
Right.
And since I did that, I started to meet loads of other people where they've had the same experience.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought I'll write a book about time and how it's not as permanent as we mm-hmm. possibly think. But before you write a book, obviously the best thing to do is do a bit of due diligence. So you go into Amazon, mm-hmm. don't you? You do a bit of search. And this wasn't a book about time management. This is about time itself. And whose book would I find but yours? So I bought it, read it. I went, okay, you just saved me a huge job there, because you've written a much better book than the one I was thinking of in the first
right.
place. And I just love that, so that idea that time and our consciousness are completely interlinked. You know, they're like bedfellows, aren't they? And I love that story you tell about the if you're in, you're on holiday, you're coming home, you've read all your books, and the plane is late. And you're sitting in the departure lounge. Could you just sort of talk us through that sequence of events?
Yeah, well, yeah. And there's a strong connection between time and boredom. Well, any negative psychological state can make time stretch. So anxiety makes time stretch. Physical pain makes time stretch out. But especially boredom, you know, especially when you're in any situation where you're waiting. So it could be a bus stop. It could be in a waiting room. It could be in a queue. But the sheer fact that when you're in a state of boredom, there's no focus for your attention. Because if you had a focus for your attention, you wouldn't be bored. So your attention is spread out, it's unfocused. And because your attention is unfocused, your mind is empty. And there's no focus for your mind, obviously. So there's a lot of chattering thoughts and images, a kind of random chatter we always experience when our attention is not occupied. So your mind fills up with that thought chatter. And usually that thought chatter tends to be negative, or it tends to focus on worries or anxieties. It kind of enhances your frustration. So yeah, so you're sitting in the departure lounge with a plane to leave, or you're sitting in a waiting room with a dentist, and there's all this stuff going through your mind. There's no focus or attention. You're impatient. You feel frustrated, and as a result, there's this massive slowing down of time which occurs. But it could be. I mean, there was some interesting research about people who tried to give up smoking. So the research tested people in a few days after they'd given up smoking. And it found out that the research found that for those people, time was moving slower. They always estimated more time than they've actually passed, you know, because they were in a state of irritation and frustration. So yeah, there's a strong connection there.
What was the connection then between you? You know, you wrote The Fall, which is a book which is now on my shopping list. And you went to Waking from Sleep, which is about. So you went from The Fall to Making Time.
To Making Time. Yeah. Which
they seem like kind of slightly different topics, don't they?
Yeah, they do, yeah. But it was kind of like, in a way, Making Time was... I wrote it before The Fall, but I put it on hold for a while and wrote The Fall and got The Fall published first when I returned to Making Time. But Making Time, it kind of grew out of my theories about perception. I've always been interested, for example, in the way that children perceive the world, because children obviously see the world in a very fresh and intense way. They're seeing everything for the first time, they're experiencing everything for the first time. So the world is incredibly vivid and intense to them. And that's one of the reasons, because of this fresh perception, that's one of the reasons why time goes so slowly for them. You know, the typical story about children saying we're nearly there yet, and not being able to wait because every few minutes seems like hours, an hour to them. So yeah, I was always interested in the link between perception and time. And then, from my own experiences, you probably have the same experience when you go to a foreign environment, an environment which is very different to your home environment, and not necessarily a tourist complex. I mean, you could fly around the world, but you still go to an environment which is very similar to your home environment. But if you go to an environment which is fairly unfamiliar to you, then after a few days, if you go home after a few days, you usually have the feeling that a lot of time has passed. You get back home and feel like you've been away for, you know, a few weeks rather than a few days. So I was always aware of this connection between unfamiliarity and time as well. So unfamiliarity seems to make time stretch out. And then I made the connection that unfamiliarity is all about perception as well, because when you're in an unfamiliar environment, you're perceiving it in a much more intense way than your home environment, because when you're in your home environment, you've switched off to the experience around you. You don't pay attention to the experience you have in your home environment, because in a sense your brain has switched off to the familiarity. But when you go to a foreign environment, your brain wakes up again and you're perceiving all this newness and freshness, so that makes time slow down. But then there's a whole aspect of The Fall which is about the ego as well, which is about you know, how the ego, the intensification of the ego at a certain point in human history led to the emergence of all of these characteristics like male domination and hierarchical societies. But time was also part of that too, because most what I call pre-fall societies, or like indigenous cultures, they have a very non-linear perception of time. You know, they tend to be very present-centered and not particularly interested in the future and the past. But once the ego developed and became very intensified, then it created this very linear sense of time. You know, we're very aware of the future stretching ahead of us. We're very aware of the past stretching behind us. So time is linked to the ego as well. The sense of linear time is definitely linked to our strong sense of ego. So I wanted to explore that in Making Time as well. So in a sense, it did partly grow out of The Fall.
And how did it morph into Waking from Sleep then? What's the connection between Making Time and Waking from Sleep?
Well, again, it was just another area of my interest. I've always been interested in these intense states of consciousness, and these moments of intense perception when the world becomes more real. And, you know, the kind of intense perception you sometimes get when you go to a foreign country, you know, everything looks exhilarating, real and fresh, and you know, at the end of the day, you feel as though your mind's processed a massive amount of experience. And, you know, and part of that is awakening experiences too. In awakening experiences, there is always this sense of heightened perception that the world becomes more real, and it becomes more exhilarating, more meaningful. And so I was really rather than looking into aspects of time, which follow on from awakening experiences, I decided to look into awakening experiences themselves and analyze them. So all my books are really, they're all really connected to my underlying interest, which is in higher states of consciousness. I think, in a sense, everything I write is about higher states of consciousness.
So if I'm reading between the lines here, Steve, you're doing a job and writing about and being paid for something which is essentially your hobby and your passion.
Yeah.
Now, is that not ideal?
It's fairly ideal. And I'm also looking after my three kids as well. I do that 2 days a week. And well, that's enjoyable too, but it's hard work. But it's quite enjoyable.
And how do your family and friends take all of this? How do they sort of see Steve Taylor?
Difficult to say, really. I think my family, I hope they don't hear this interview, but I don't think they really understand what I'm writing about. Now, I've given every copy of a book I give to my parents, but I don't think they've actually read any of them yet.
Can I say snap?
Yeah, they sort of, I don't know if it's the same with your parents, but They like the fact that I've written books, and they like seeing them in the bookcases, but they feel a bit bemused by the content, I think. Is that the same with your parents?
Oh, it is. I had someone on Amazon who, you know, my book Flavors of Thought.
Yeah.
The reviewer on Amazon said better than the Bible, and my mother was horrified.
Oh no.
I didn't put her up to it, I promise.
But, right.
But I have to say that, you know, I share your journey. We're both from Manchester, which is quite kind of interesting.
Yeah.
We're both blokes, obviously. And it's kind of interesting that we're both living our hobby and we're living our passion, which is just thrilling for me.
Yeah. It's very difficult, I mean, as you probably know, it's quite difficult these days to make a living as an author, you know, because the royalty rates are quite low in the ages of, you know, the age of Amazon.
Absolutely. But, yeah, don't give up your day job, they say, don't they?
Yeah. So I think even best-selling authors find it difficult to make a living purely from writing, which is why so many authors do talks and workshops. But I think even if I could make a living purely from writing, I don't think I would take the opportunity because I enjoy teaching so much. I love giving lectures and talking to students and, you know, it's a nice balance, really, because I think, as you may, yeah, you probably maybe you feel this too, but the writing, I think if you did it all the time, it could be quite an isolating activity, and, you know, because, you know, basically you're removed from interaction with other people. So I need some interaction as well. I need to communicate with people as well as being an author.
Well, that's the source material for your next book, of course, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Because
you look at Look at some of the people you've met that you talked about in Out of Darkness. One character particularly has intrigued me, a guy called Russell Williams.
Oh, yeah.
A spiritual teacher. Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. I'd love to meet him.
Yeah, well, next time you're in Manchester, you should come down and meet him. Do you ever return to Manchester?
Yeah, I'm due a trip very shortly.
All right, well, maybe maybe you can arrange a meeting with Russell. Because, he's a really fascinating guy. He's 89 now. He's lived an amazing life, a rank-based life in Out of the Darkness. He lived an amazingly difficult and stressful early life after his parents died. And he was very involved in the Second World War. He was there in the Blitz and Dunkirk. And he had a very traumatic experiences during the war. But he had, coincidentally, the same age as Eckhart Tolle. When he was 29, he had a powerful spiritual awakening, when all of this turmoil he'd lived through seemed to culminate in this sort of massive sense of release and liberation. And, he, like a lot of people, he didn't really understand what happened to him, because obviously unless you've got a background in spirituality, unless you've got some kind of framework which enables you to understand what's happened, you're going to be in a state of confusion when this happens. So he didn't know what happened to him. He thought he'd gone a bit crazy. And when he told other people what had happened to him, they thought he was crazy too. So, you know, after a couple of years, he began to feel a bit frustrated and feel that there's something wrong with him. But then he had another awakening, I suppose, when all of this frustration gave way and he felt established in this permanent state of awakening. And then by chance he got talking to a guy who happened to be one of the founders of the Buddhist Society of Great Britain in the 1950s, a guy called John Gary, who's probably long dead by now. But he was the first person. When Russell met him, he talked about how he felt and how he perceived the world and his opinions about life. And this guy said, oh, that's pure Buddhism. You're talking pure Buddhism. And then Russell, he didn't know anything about Buddhism at all, but he just felt very glad that somebody had understood him. So this guy, John Gary, invited Russell to give talks to the Buddhist Society. So he started going there every week to give talks. And at that time, there was also a Buddhist Society in Manchester, which had also been founded in the 1950s. So they invited Russell to give talks as well, and he ended up staying in Manchester and living there. So I think he's been in Manchester now for probably over 50 years. And he gives meetings twice a week. This house, not his house, it used to be his house, but he gave it to the Buddhist Society of Manchester, and he lives elsewhere now. But he still goes there twice a week to give talks. And he's great. I was actually there last night. I try to go every couple of weeks or so. And he's got this amazing spiritual aura, so as you call this sort of feeling around him. A lot of people go there not so much to listen to what he says, although what he says is very incredibly wise and illuminating. But I think a lot of people go to see him just for the feeling, the sense of peace that radiates around him. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a very, very good excuse. Like three excuses now to come up to Manchester. So that's it.
Yeah.
But as a kind of segue, which is nothing connected with this at all, but you talk a lot about death in the book as being this great awakener, don't you? People talk about near-death experiences and what have you. And not that I'm driving up to Manchester to have one of these, but why is death so powerful?
Well, I think there are lots of experiences which can bring about spiritual awakening, and obviously turmoil is one of them. And I think what happens when people get into states of turmoil and states of depression or despair, often what happens in these states, the reason why we feel so desperate and so full of despair in these states is because things that we depend on for our happiness are taken away. So it could be a relationship ending which you depend on for your happiness. It could be maybe your job is taken away. It could be anything that you depend on. It could be your hopes for the future are destroyed. Maybe your beliefs are destroyed. You could have certain beliefs which you depend on for your happiness. But if any of these things are destroyed, obviously it puts you into a state of turmoil and despair. There's a massive sense of loss. But also when that happens, there's actually a sense of, there's actually some potential for liberation as well. Because I call these the things that we depend on for our happiness, I call them psychological attachments. So in a sense, our ego gets attached to these things. It gets attached to beliefs. It gets attached to hopes. It gets attached to people. It gets attached to status, our status in society, to the identity which we get from our jobs or from the achievements or the successes we've had. And all of which is fine, but if we depend on these things for our happiness and they're destroyed, as I said, it obviously causes turmoil. But at the same time, it's a liberating thing as well, because these attachments are taken away. So all of the scaffolding which supports the ego is taken away. So there's kind of like a space where there used to be all these attachments. And also, it's important that when all the scaffolding fades away or is destroyed, then the ego itself has got nothing to support it anymore. So the our normal sense of self, which we call the ego, that can just dissolve away, so that our normal identity just suddenly dissolves away. So all of a sudden there's this space in our psyche where the normal identity used to be, the normal self used to be. And that space enables, or there's kind of a almost like a latent higher self, which I think is inside everybody. But when there's this space in our psyche, it allows this latent higher self to come through and emerge, almost like a butterfly emerging from a caterpillar.
So it's like a rebirth then? Or I've heard this phrase walk-ins. Have you heard the phrase walk-ins?
Yeah. So the connection with death is that when you encounter death, there's always a sense of loss when you encounter death, because you know that if you're going to die, all of the things you depend on for your well-being are going to be taken away. You know, so your future's going to be taken away. All of your success, your achievements are going to be taken away. All of your material goods are going to be taken away. Everything's going to be taken away. So it can be a massive, you know, all of your psychological attachments can dissolve away. Some people obviously cling to them, you know, and they're in a mood of bitterness and frustration, which is obviously quite normal and natural. But some people, if they get to a state where they accept that all of these things are going to be taken away and no longer cling to them, no longer feel frustrated and bitter about it, if you get into this state of acceptance, then that's when the transformation can occur. That's when the normal ego can give way and this latent higher self can emerge and then come through.
So is there a way then of us having this kind of pseudo-death without going through the trauma of a near-death experience and going through the same transformation?
Yeah, well, I know. I mean, I didn't really want to say to people, you know, the only way to find spiritual awakening is by encountering death. So I don't really want to encourage people to...
You haven't got shares in Dignitas then?
No. No, that would be a bit unethical. But there are certain ways of doing it. I mean, even... there are different ways of encountering your own death. I mean, I don't know if you know the psychologist Stan Grof. He's got this procedure where he puts people into a kind of hypnotic state through breathing exercises, and he encourages people to relive their own birth. And he believes that birth and death are interconnected, that birth is essentially the same as death. He calls it the death rebirth experience. And so that when people experience their own birth, they're also, in a sense, experiencing death as well. So he believes that when people undergo this experience, they can also, they get some of the effects of actually encountering death, a sense of appreciation and liberation. And also, just imagining that you're going to die in a certain amount of time. There's a therapy called the Year to Live therapy, developed by a guy called Stephen Levine in America. And the therapy is based on the idea that you are going to die in a year from now, and you go through the whole process of, writing letters to people, reconnecting people that you haven't had contact with, repairing broken relationships. So basically, you treat your whole life as if you are really going to die in 1 year, and eventually, subconsciously, you actually begin to believe that. So that changes your perception of reality. You get that sense of detachment and liberation. But also, I think, I mean, obviously, we live in a very death-denying culture as well. And we're not encouraged to face death or even think about it. But I think we should, you know, face death very directly. We should accept it. We should think about it. When people we know are dying, we should, you know, spend time with them. And we should never, you know, skirt around the subject. We should face it directly. So I think even just reminding ourselves about death, some people might say it's morbid, but I don't think it's morbid at all. I think it's quite... On the one hand, it's just facing up to reality. It's also potentially liberating as well to... You know, many, many people have experienced spiritual awakening through encountering death.
Okay, and so in a year's time from now, Steve, where are you? What's the next book that's happening, and where do you see...
I thought you meant in a year's time from now, you know, facing my death in a year's time from now, like the therapy.
I wasn't gonna challenge with that question. I thought that was just too harsh on air to do that. But I just wondered, just in general, a year's time from now, where you saw yourself and what your direction is going to be.
Well, I'm hoping to start teaching a course on positive psychology at the university in Leeds, which would be great because I've always wanted to do that. I mean, I don't think there's any other university in this country which teaches courses on positive psychology, and obviously in America there are. So that's we're hoping to begin that in about probably January next year. So that'd be good. And I'm scheduled to write a new book as well, which is supposedly going to be published in about a year's time from now. So I'm going to have to get busy with that soon. I've got to hand it in to the publishers by the end of September. And I haven't written a word yet, so...
Oh, is that right?
But I'm just hoping...
Well, as you're an expert at making time, that shouldn't be an issue, really.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'll probably leave it till about 2 weeks before and just make some time and, you know, plunge into a time hole and make time expand so I've got lots of time to do it.
Perfect. That's one of my tricks. And actually, one of the tricks I teach my students is how to channel their future selves, so their future selves know the words they haven't written yet, and you can get them sent back to the present. So that's quite a nice trick to.
Oh, right.
Quite a nice trick to pull.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah.
So, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you this evening, Steve. What's the best place for people to find you? Because you've got a couple of websites, haven't you? I noticed you've got the academic website, which I'm looking at the moment, where it's got Beyond the Pre-Stroke Trans Fallacy, the Validity from Pre-Egoic Spiritual Experience. You've got your blog site, and you've got your main website. What's the best place for people to get you?
The best site is my main site, which is StephenMTaylor.com. So Stephen with a V, StephenMTaylor.com.
And where can people see you?
Because I've got young children, I don't tend to do many. I don't travel very much, so I don't tend to do many workshops and talks, but. I occasionally do workshops in Manchester, maybe every 3 or 4 months I do workshops in Manchester. And every month or two I do a talk in different areas. I'm going to be in London in August, Birmingham in July. So, yeah, if people want information about the talks, the best place is to look on my website.
And if you can give people one tip about something they can do right now to awaken, what would that be?
Right. Well, I would say, rather than doing something, I'd say do nothing. I'd say turn everything off, turn the TV off, turn the computer off, turn your mobile phone off, turn everything off, and just try and be fully aware of where you are at this particular moment, and try and give your full attention to everything around you, to the walls around you, the doors, the clock. Just try and live in it. Try and cultivate a sense of stillness in this particular moment, and be fully aware of, the phenomena all around you.
Wow, that is so profound, Steve. So, how about if we did a live experiment now on this show, and we did something that broadcasters never do, and we just were quiet for 60 seconds? How would that be?
That sounds great. Yeah, just. Let's just experience the silence and stillness for a few seconds.
Let's broadcast nothing for 60 seconds. Well, Steve, great pleasure to talk to you. And hope we can speak again soon. Look forward to getting the next book. And I will buy a copy of The Fall now, my next thing to do. But let's be quiet for 60 seconds.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you so much.